welcome back to HealthLink On Air, produced each week by Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. This is your host, Tricia Torrey, Every Patient's Advocate. Well, listeners, over the years, you've heard us state that mental health and physical health are closely tied together. And throughout your lifetime, you've probably heard the maxim, mind over matter. Well, the person sharing the studio with me this morning may be the guru, the person who understands this concept better than most. At least, let me introduce you to Dr. Montaj Dhawan, Chair of Psychiatry at Upstate, recently quoted in this very topic in the New York Times. Welcome, Dr. Dhawan. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
We've actually tried to get you here for a very long time, so now that we have you, we're going to get you to talk to us for quite a while this morning. We have many topics around this whole idea of physical health and mental health, psychiatry, psychology. We have a long ways to go, so I'm glad you can hang in there with us. In the introduction I gave just a minute ago, I repeated a phrase that we hear, mind over matter. And in this New York Times article you were quoted in, it talks about that relationship and maybe some of the differences in talk therapy and the use of pharmaceutical drugs for depression. So let's go back, if we can, and talk about psychiatry and psychology and maybe some of the differences.
So I think the primary difference is that psychiatrists are trained as medical doctors first and then study psychology as well as matters that deal with the brain and hopefully use both of them wisely in combination at times to get the best results for the patients.
And when you talk about the best results, we're not necessarily talking about, say, a tumor in the brain or something like that. We're talking about something that's a lot less measurable than that. Emotions, attitudes. So talk to us a little bit about that part of it.
Well, that's exactly right. We have some hints at where some of these reside in the brain, but really have not nailed it down as clearly as you can see a tumor. But there's certainly very exciting work in brain imaging that is helping us understand where some of our thinking resides, where some of our emotions reside, and how we can influence them by using medications as well as psychotherapy. The most exciting finding, I thought, in the 90s came from a study which showed that psychotherapy changed the brain, the physical part functioning of the brain, as much as medications did.
And when you're talking about psychotherapy, you're not talking about drugs.
Correct. I'm talking about talk therapy in
talk
the more
therapy.
Traditional.
Right. And so we might think of going to a counselor and spending time with a counselor who can guide our way of thinking or, say, reacting to things. That's what you're talking about when you say psychotherapy.
That's correct.
Now, there was another term introduced in this article, which I had never heard before, but I instantly knew what it meant, psychopharmacology. Tell us what that is.
Well, I think it's essentially a takeoff on what we were just discussing, where the idea was to use medications to change everything that we have considered as psychology, where the thinking, the behaving, the patterns of who we are can be manipulated, if you will, by using the right medication.
And manipulated is a very good word, because that's what we are attempting to do in a lot of cases.
That's exactly right. We don't have them as specifically as we would like, you know, a drug for each manipulation, but that's certainly been the goal.
And who's we, when you say as specific as we'd like?
Well, I think it's every doctor's dream to sort of say, here's a pathological symptom and we should be able to get rid of it. You know, you have a headache and let's get something that takes it away. In the same way, if we could have psychological distress, if somebody could take away tears by just giving them medications, that would be wonderful.
I think it's interesting that you chose the doctors as we, because in a lot of cases, I think the patients would also be we. We would like to think that if we are depressed, you could give us a pill and tomorrow we won't be.
That's correct.
Or even this afternoon, if it could function that quickly. But this has kind of evolved. Part of what was fascinating, again, going back to this article, part of what was fascinating was this description of psychiatrists as, and we're talking many years ago, a couple of generations ago, perhaps, feeling a little bit on the outs of medical science and sort of feeling like they had to prove that they were actually medical doctors. Talk to us a little bit about that history.
I think it's a very fascinating history where especially American psychiatry started off as an offshoot of neurology. It was actually, psychiatry was initially a specialty that didn't exist, and neurologists did all the treatment in the psychiatric field. It broke off over almost 200 years ago, and formed its own society. And there's been this sort of tension between, are you a neurologist or are you a psychiatrist, since you, in some sense, share the brain. And then the discussions have moved forward with the advent of Freud and his work, where it became significantly more psychological. And
problems in the brain became more psychological?
Well, no, actually, the approach to understanding people with problems became more psychological.
Okay.
And so there was a emphasis not on understanding the brain, which we knew was the sort of seat of the emotions and thinking, but in understanding it more in terms of how we were raised and how we saw the world and how we integrated who we were with where we were in the world, and began to become people with strengths and weaknesses. And some of the weaknesses spilt over into pathology. So psychiatry has struggled with trying to figure out...
Now, wait a minute. I want to analyze that.
Okay.
What do you mean now? Some of the weaknesses spilled over into pathology. Explain that.
So it's okay to be a little anxious. We all are, as I am in this situation. But if I am...
Sitting in front of a microphone?
Right, exactly.
You don't do that every day.
No, I don't. And so that's fine. It just sort of keeps you on your toes. A little bit of anxiety keeps you on your toes, makes you study for exams, makes you prepare in advance. But once it gets more than that, it overwhelms you, and then you get an anxiety disorder, which is very common.
So that's where you're talking about the pathology, is it really can be measured in the brain.
Correct. It can be measured in the brain, and certainly it has very clear symptoms that the person comes to you with, I am dysfunctional because my anxiety won't let me do what I need to do. And so you can see it symptomatically, but you can also now measure it in the brain.
It's been interesting to me. We've done other interviews about functional MRIs, for instance.
That's
the
okay.
idea of taking pictures of the brain and then measuring how, say, emotions affect the brain, how different kinds of stimuli that might be considered to be, quote-unquote, softer science, and I think that's a term that a lot of scientists use, how those things can actually be measured. And it strikes me that psychiatry, that maybe one of the reasons psychiatrists have had to work so hard for this kind of recognition is because prior to that, there really wasn't a way to measure it easily.
That's correct. But even now, when we say we can see it and measure it, it's not something that you can say, here's a scan, here's your anxiety, therefore you have a diagnosis.
Like we would say, here's your tumor,
exactly,
and therefore
exactly.
I see.
So I think we're headed in that direction, but we're nowhere near having something that's definitive.
Well, in the meantime, as you said, you can discuss symptoms. And we started developing, we as a group of people, mm-hmm. not as you and I as individuals, we started developing pharmacological approaches to fixing some of those emotions and attitudes we had. And that's kind of where this psychopharmacology came along. But that also presented its own set of problems, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I think the tradition that Freud brought to us was very long-term psychotherapy. People were seen for an hour once a day, 5 days a week, for years.
Specifically to talk.
And it was a very long, very expensive treatment that only a few people were well-trained to provide.
And only a few people could really afford.
That's correct. Probably fewer could afford than we would certainly like. And when the medications came along, it certainly seemed like a very promising step forward. And it did make an enormous difference, particularly for the more severe mental disorders. Schizophrenia was dramatically changed, for example. The psychoses are much, much easier to treat now with the medications.
And what were some of those early medications? When did they come to pass, and what were they?
So the earliest medications came in the 50s, where chlorpromazine was one of the first antipsychotics that came along and really changed the field. Lithium came a few years later.
Yeah, I remember the name lithium.
Mm-hmm. In the 60s and became sort of the standard for treating what we then called manic depressive illness and now called bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm.
The anxiolytics have again been very, very helpful and widely used. At one point, I think Xanax was probably the widest used medication in the world. So, and then you've got certainly the more popular press came with Prozac, which in 1990 or so, really became part of the culture.
Sure. And you would hear about all that time. And you even heard euphemisms for these kinds of drugs. I remember the mother's little helper.
Yes.
You know, and that was, they were even singing about that back in the 60s, weren't
right,
they?
Right.
And people would self-medicate too as well, wouldn't they? Alcohol?
Sure.
Illegal drugs?
Sure. Everyone's looking to feel a little bit better with
Everybody
whatever you can get a hold of.
To feel a little bit better. Well, one of the very fascinating topics from this particular article, and again, you were quoted in it, and we're going to get to where you were quoted because I think it's fascinating. They started talking about the placebo effect. So let's examine that a little bit. We've only got about a minute before we need to break for the news. But tell us first what the placebo effect is.
Well, very simply, if a doctor who you could sort of briefly see as an authority figure with some credibility gives you anything, there is some help from just that.
Just the fact that you think it might help you.
That's correct. And it's given by somebody who says that it may help you. And if it's said very distinctly that it will help you, that's even better. So the placebo effect is just a very clear message that I am here to help you, and here is something that will help.
Right. And it doesn't matter what the composition is of that drug they're giving you, it will help you in some way anyway.
That's correct. It's usually inert, so there's no composition in that
sense.
Very
good. That's a great place to break, because I hope listeners will stay with us through the news. We're going to take a break. This is Upstate's HealthLink on air on 570 WSYR. Well, welcome back to HealthLink On Air, produced each week by Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. This is your host, Tricia Torrey, every patient's advocate. In the studio with me this morning is Dr. Montosh Dewan, Chair of Psychiatry at Upstate. We're talking about psychotherapy, talk therapy, versus pharmatherapy, drug therapy, how that affects the brain, what kinds of outcomes there are, a little bit about the history of psychiatry. We've already covered a lot of territory, haven't we, Dr. Dewan?
Yes, it's been fun.
We have. Okay, and as we took a break for the news, we started talking about placebos, and we want to make that distinction that placebo can be something you swallow. I think that's how most of us lay people think about it. But you're really talking about the placebo effect. And what is the effect of a placebo? You started with the authority figure, so let's pick it up from there.
Yeah, so I think traditionally we've looked at in drug trials where you're trying to study a medication, so you give a medication, which is an active ingredient, and then an inactive ingredient in an identical-looking pill, and we call that the placebo, to see if the active ingredient is significantly better
right.
than this inactive.
And we make sure that it looks identical so that the people taking the one with the active ingredient versus the ones who aren't, they both think they're taking whatever the pill is.
That's correct. And we also don't let the doctors or the prescriber or the nurse who's giving it know the difference.
Uh-huh.
So both sides, the giver as well as the taker, doesn't know which is the placebo and which is active.
And in a typical study having to do with psychiatry and these kinds of drugs, how long will a study like that last? I mean, I realize that they're going to vary depending on what you're trying to show one way or the other. But, I mean, are these things that are studied, the placebo effect, has that been studied over a long term or a short term or both? Or
Almost inevitably short term. Drug trials traditionally run 6 weeks.
Oh, they do? Okay. All right. Tell us now what the outcomes have been in trials showing the placebo effect.
So it's actually one of the consistent findings that placebos are very effective. And
remembering that there's nothing in them.
That's correct.
There
there's
might
nothing
be
in them.
A little bit of flour or, you know, some ingredient that makes no difference whatsoever.
That's correct. They look identical, but they are very different in terms of what's in them.
So the only real difference is what somebody thinks is going to happen.
That's correct. And even though they know that they may have a chance of getting a placebo, they still hope and think that they may get the active drug. The findings are striking. So if you take depression as an example, if you take an active drug that we know is an antidepressant, about 50% of people will do well on that. Still a small number, but 50% will respond in 6 weeks to this drug. If you take a placebo with nothing in it, about 35% to 40% will also say that they are feeling much better.
Really?
To the same degree as if you took the active drug. This is often repeated in many of the other conditions, less so in certain conditions like obsessive compulsive disorder. Mm-hmm. The difference is marked. The placebo response is very small. And that's always interesting on why certain
sure.
disorders respond and certain
sure.
don't. But by and large, there is a really significant and marked response to placebos, not just in terms of people feeling better, but equally interesting, they will get the side effects that
really?
From placebos that they will complain of headaches and diarrhea just as much as people on the drugs.
Now, and then we have to wonder whether they actually read that those were potential side effects.
They were told about this.
They were told about them. So they did know on the front end
exactly. That
they might get those side effects.
Exactly.
And then tell me, you said that the doctors didn't know which patients were and weren't getting them. What was the setup, let's say, from the doctors before the patients started taking them? How was it described to them? So, therefore, did that authority telling them that it might work help the matter at all?
Well, in this case, the trials are set up so that you say we're going to study 100 depressed patients, and two-thirds of them will get an active drug, a third of them will not, and those are randomized. So the doctors don't know who's going to get it. It's just a number, and then you get a pill.
Right, but what I mean is the doctor says to you, and this might be more anecdotal having to do with what you know about the placebo effect, but if the doctor says it's going to work, we're giving you this drug and we're pretty sure that it's going to have this effect on you, how much does that affect whether it has that effect on the patient?
Well, I think that's a huge effect, clearly, a huge effect. And certainly in clinical practice, it's even larger. The more authority, the more clear you are about this is going to be helpful, I think it is helpful. In drug trials, it's a little bit more neutral because you present it as, here's what we are trying to study, here's what we think will happen, here are the side effects that may occur, and you present it a little bit more neutrally, but certainly expecting that there will be a positive response.
Very interesting. Let's shift just a little bit, because I think that this ties into another aspect of what we're talking about here, and that is, we alluded to it earlier on, that whole balance, let's say, between talk therapy, psychotherapy, and pharmatherapy, drug therapy. When we talked about the science shifting in psychiatry to sort of prove, quote unquote, that there was a medical benefit to this kind of thing, we really do now have drugs galore, and they're everywhere. They're on our TVs, they're in our medicine cabinets, they're in our understanding of what psychiatry is about. But there are some studies that you've done now that show how that needs to be balanced. And I think that listeners will find it very interesting, because we assume that you take a drug and it has an effect. But it turns out that there might be some differences there. Talk to us about those.
So what I think the academic difference between mind over matter, which the article talks about, really refers to, should we be using medications? Should we be using psychotherapy, which is basically talk therapy, understanding people? And my feeling is that that's an academic argument, very helpful to sort of say what works under what conditions. But really, if you focus on the patient, then it becomes clear that you need to do both. You really need to take into account who the person is, understand what their circumstances are, figure out their symptoms, which may then be translated into medical terminology, and then you have the choice of treating them with medications only, or with psychotherapy only, or a combination of the two. And I think that that serves the patient best. So the academic arguments need to be translated into what's best for the patient.
You know, it's interesting, because we know, especially now in the throes of healthcare reform and so forth, we know that the time that patients have with their doctors is, in general, and I'm not talking about just in psychiatry at the moment, but in general, we have less and less and less time with our doctors. Also, our expectation level is that there's going to be a silver bullet for whatever is wrong with us. You're going to be able to fix whatever it is with a drug or even a quick surgery or something like that. So I think the expectations on really both sides of the equation between the doctors and the patients is that there should be a quick and easy fix. And we've looked to drugs to do that. So if I hear what you're saying, maybe that's not the best fix, even if it's the quickest and easiest.
Well, I wish it was quick and easy, but it's not the best because it's not effective. So again, if you look at depression, recent data suggests that if you take one drug to begin with, only a third of patients get better, all the way better. About 50% will improve some. And
when you define better, I mean, maybe we need to go, okay, when you say all the way better, what does that include? Does that mean that they take the drug and they stay that way? Or does it mean that eventually they go off the drug and they stay that way?
Complicated question.
I'm sure.
So step one is, if you took a drug, you have 33% chance of getting completely depression-free and going back to the way you were and functioning the way you were.
With or without the drug?
Right. So one is just so that you're now depression-free.
Okay.
And then the more difficult question is, what do you need to do to stay depression-free?
Mm-hmm.
And data suggests that you need to take the drug for about 9 months to a year to get the best chances of remaining depression-free.
Okay.
The data also suggests that some people will obviously not do well. Since only a third did well,
sure.
What do you do with the two-thirds who didn't do well?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that becomes a real challenge. There's a very important study that was released recently where if you have one drug and then you have three sequential treatments, three other drugs in combinations or replacements, all done for 3 months, very carefully monitored that you actually took the drugs, at the end of a year of active treatment with four different kinds of medications, only two-thirds of patients were depression-free. So we know that the results are not very good. And again, what I want to come back to
unless
is...
Unless you're one of those two-thirds.
Well, but I worry about the one-third
yes,
that have
right.
not responded.
That's right.
And it's taken a year of great effort to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I would want to come back to say. I think we need to then throw in psychotherapy, not as an add-on, not as an afterthought, but as something that is very, very important to think about right from the beginning, because you want to get to everybody feeling depression-free, everyone doing well.
Sure.
And even when you combine the two, there's no study that can get you to 100% relief. So to leave out something that is effective makes no sense. And the argument is really not something that we should share with patients. I think we need to look at patients in terms of everything we can do to help them get better. All the way better.
Patients are individuals, and everybody's chemistry and biology is different.
Correct.
So if I hear what you're saying that each patient needs to be approached individually to figure out what the best combination is going to be for them. But you can't do that unless you spend some time with those patients. And that's really, going back to this article from the New York Times, that's really where it started, was a doctor who felt like he'd been one of those who was writing the prescriptions. He felt like he knew his patients, but until he actually made the conscious effort to spend more time with each one of the patients, he realized he didn't know them as well as he should have. And the example he gave was where he realized he had the wrong diagnosis. How frequently do you think that happens?
I worry that it happens a great deal. To imagine or think that you can understand somebody in 20 minutes is really...
And prescribe for them.
Is really a fallacy. I don't think you can get it right. You certainly can't get it right all the time. And I think that time is of the essence, and we need lots of time to understand our patients. Since we don't have tests, we don't have exams that will give us the exact right answer.
Sure.
It's really spending the time to know the people. And people are reluctant to give you their secrets. You know, that's what gives you the answer.
That's true.
And so I'll use a quick example of somebody, if you're seeing them 20 minutes at a time, come in and say, I'm much depressed, much more depressed now. The doctor's only response is, well, let's give you more of the medication or change to something more powerful as he sees it.
And in fairness, that's what he's been taught to do.
And that's what he's been taught to do and does it in good conscience and good faith. But it may be a simple case of the marriage has deteriorated.
Mm-hmm.
And if we fix that, you've got a much better chance of the person feeling better than giving them medication and saying, it's all right if your husband still beats you. We think this medication will make you feel better, which is ludicrous when you think about it.
It does seem to be that way. And I would say that the takeaway maybe for our listeners this morning is something along the lines of, if you have depression issues or mental health issues of whatever form they are, if you are seeing someone who is writing you a prescription within 20 minutes, and if your expectation is that that's going to fix everything, you might need to readjust your thinking and try a different approach.
That's correct. And I think patients need to be very, very clear that their goal should be completely depression-free, not just a little bit better.
Ah, that's an interesting one, too. So we're asking patients to raise their level of expectations in terms of an outcome, but to change their expectations in terms of the approach to that outcome.
And I would hope doctors would do the same thing.
Doctors aren't going to be rewarded to do the same thing necessarily, though, are they, by insurance?
No, that's correct. Actually, it's the opposite. Doctors are rewarded to see lots of patients very quickly, and the quality of care doesn't really come into this. You get paid to do a lot very quickly. And medications is the only thing you get paid for based on no time limit. So
right.
you can see people for 5 minutes and get the same amount of money
right.
as you would if you saw them for 50 minutes.
So let's take that back to patients. Patients need to be looking for somebody who will spend the time and make sure that the goal really is depression-free or problem-free and the right approach for them.
That's correct. And even with that, it's a challenge.
It still is a challenge. Well, Dr. Montosh Dewan from Upstate's Department of Psychiatry, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for spending time with us this morning. We hope we'll see you again soon.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And listeners, we do need to take a break. Please stay with us. This is Upstate's HealthLink on air on 570 WSYR.